Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we'll be speaking with Diane Seuss and Gabe Gomez from the Muse Times 2 poetry series at Collected Works. I'd like now to welcome Don Hamilton. He's a doctor of veterinary medicine, and he's the author of the new book, Homeopathic Care for Cats and Dogs, Small Doses for Small Animals. And he will be speaking at Garcia Street Books this coming Saturday, the 26th of February at 3 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, this is it's actually a new edition of a book that has already been quite successful. It's a second edition. And it's about, among other things, I mean, it's about homeopathic care for animals. It's also about your journey with animals and your journey as a veterinarian. You started off as a conventional veterinarian. You did emergency care. You did regular clinical care. And it was, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was noticing chronic skin conditions in the animals that came in for veterinary care that prompted you to start thinking about new ways to treat.
That's correct. Skin conditions are sort of the bane of most veterinarians' practice because they're extremely difficult to manage. Even with homeopathics and what I know now, I can do a lot better than I used to. But basically, in conventional medicine, for many skin conditions, we had steroids and sometimes antibiotics, and sometimes you might use antihistamines. But basically, steroids were the sort of the central pillar of our practice 25 years ago. For a lot of skin conditions, because they're an immune reaction, an immune overreaction. So we could give steroids, we'd calm it down. Somebody bring in a cat or dog that was itching like crazy. You could put them on steroids. 24 hours, the dog's not itching, and he's happy, and everybody's happy, and the people are sleeping, and the dog's not keeping them up at night sleeping. But it was dangerous to keep them on those drugs for very long. And so after a couple weeks, 3 weeks, you'd have to taper it off, and then the people come back, they want more drugs, and I might give them one refill, and same thing would happen, and they'd come back and want more drugs, and I'd say, I can't give you any more. It's not safe for the dog. They'd be upset. I'd be upset. You know, it doesn't work, because all those things do is palliate. They temporarily alleviate the condition, but as soon as you stop the medication, it comes right back, sometimes worse than it was when you put them on it.
Tell us more about those skin conditions. Why are so many dogs and cats getting these problems? I mean, is it insects? Is it things that stick into them when they go on their walks, plant stuff?
It's really a susceptibility issue, and it's an internally generated problem that the animal has. It's like they're allergic. In a lot of cases, they're allergic conditions, and they might be allergic to fleas, or they might be allergic to foods, or they might be allergic to pollens. But the question is, why is that dog allergic, and why is this other dog not allergic? And that's the problem.
That's the problem with us, too.
That's the problem with us, too. And my experience over 32 years now of veterinary medicine is that vast numbers of these, the problem is the vaccines, actually, because the vaccines hyper-stimulate the immune system.
The vaccines to what?
To anything. The distemper,
parvo,
rabies. Yes. Those vaccines, which can have their benefit, but they also stimulate the immune system in ways that aren't normal, particularly by bypassing the oral nasal route in the gastrointestinal tract and going right in with an injection with an organism like parvo that normally is transmitted through the mouth or the nose. And so it bypasses some of our normal levels, and that's one problem. There are also additives in the vaccines that are adjuvants and other preservatives that either stimulate a stronger immune reaction, and some of the preservatives like mercury and aluminum and so forth also are toxic.
But the mercury has been out of vaccines for 10 years.
No. They say it is.
They have in human vaccines.
Not really, no.
Well, that's another conversation.
They say that they have, but they've actually just kind of decreased the dose, and it is another conversation. So at any rate, what happens with these, I mean, that's one problem. The other problem is that we've had a history of over-vaccinating. And so when I graduated from veterinary school, we were taught you vaccinate every year for the entire life of the dog or the cat.
For rabies.
For rabies, for distemper, for parvo, for
really?
The cat distemper and everything.
Because now it's you get all those once, And then only the rabies you get every few years.
The rabies is every 3 years. The more progressive clinics are doing every 3 years on the distemper parvo combination, the DHLPP combination. A lot of practices still give it every year. I mean, basically how it should be done is if we believe in vaccinations, and I have qualms about that, but is to do this a couple vaccines as a puppy and then be finished with it, or as a kitten. Like with children, and you know, we vaccinate up until about 12 years of age, and then we stop. We don't continue vaccinating.
So you, in your view, the there would be no chronic skin conditions in cats and dogs if they were not vaccinated against parvo, rabies, and so on?
Well, I'm not saying that's the only cause. It's a major cause. I think it's a huge cause. There are plenty of other causes as well. Anything that stresses the body's health. I mean, the vaccines are bad because they do so hyper-stimulate the immune system. But other things that can also induce allergies or can induce chronic disease include pesticides, drugs, probably EMFs. I mean, we're learning more and more about cell phone and wireless, and all that is very dangerous, very debilitating also to the body. So we have lots of possibilities of things that cause the immune system not to work properly. Most of them suppress the immune system, whereas the vaccines, as a rule, tend to hyper-immunize and hyper-stimulate the immune system. And there have been conventional research studies that have shown this. They've shown autoantibodies following vaccination with distemper vaccine, for example, in the dog.
So how did you come upon homeopathy as a way of dealing with the health of dogs and cats?
After I'd been out of school about 5-6 years, so in the mid-1980s, I was reaching this conundrum with the various skin disease and chronic diseases, and so I just started looking elsewhere to see what other modalities were out there that might offer something. I first studied acupuncture because, you know, it had been more well accepted and still is much more well accepted. And so in like 1985-86, I studied acupuncture, and through that I met people who were doing homeopathy and learned about homeopathy. And while I think acupuncture is a marvelous modality and I really like the theories of Chinese medicine, it didn't fit me in terms of my practice and what I do. So I began studying homeopathy, and after a couple of kind of wild, lucky successes in some cases that my conventional training had taught me were impossible to heal, with homeopathy, I healed them, and that hooked me at that point.
Would you like to describe some of those early successes?
Sure. One of them, one that was probably, the most powerful in that it was extremely early on in my study and I didn't really know a whole lot, was the dog that about 2 years previously had fallen out of the back of a pickup, and it therefore had a, he could walk, but he was very weak in the hind legs and would stumble and so forth. And so they came to me after having been to a couple universities and, you know, specialists in the, they'd run the gamut of everything conventional medicine knew. And they came to me because they found out I was doing something different. And I gave a homeopathic remedy called conium maculatum, which is hemlock, which, if you recall, is what Socrates took for it as his death.
Right. It's not that good for you at its full strength,
that's
shall
right.
we say.
That's right. And at full strength, what it does is it causes an ascending paralysis. It first numbs your hind legs, and then it kind of creeps up the body until it paralyzes the respiratory system, which is how it kills. In the homeopathic form, though, it doesn't do that because they're prepared specifically and highly diluted. But homeopathically, homeopathic remedies can treat symptom diseases that present with symptoms that are similar to what the substance can do in its natural state. So I chose conium as a possible remedy because of this hind end paralysis thing. And I told the people that, you know, in a couple of weeks to check in with me. So in 2 weeks, they called, and I asked how the dog was doing, and she said after 48 hours, she said, you never know the dog had any problem. And, you know, I kind of said, really? Because I knew it could do it, but, you know, seeing it, and the theory is one thing, and the observation is another. And that just hooked me. It was extraordinary.
I have read about and actually tried without, I have to say, much success in my own life, homeopathic remedies, but I found the theory fascinating. Tell us what it is and the theory of how it's supposed to work.
Nobody really knows exactly how it works other than sort of in a symbolic sense in a way. There have been researches to try to understand the mechanism, but it works on sort of a quantum physics level, and that's one of the issues, is because homeopathic medications are diluted beyond Avogadro's number, which is to say that according to conventional physics, they don't have any particles left in them, but somehow it's using the energy of it. But the way it was uncovered is Samuel Hahnemann, who was the German MD who practiced in the late 1700s, early 1800s, and himself became disgusted with conventional medicine of his days because he couldn't help his own children and so forth. And as he was translating some medical texts, there was a text on use of the quinquina bark, which we now, from what we now extract quinine. And Hahnemann, well, the fellow who wrote the textbook, had postulated the reasons that the quinine worked. And Hahnemann, as a chemist and an MD, didn't quite buy his thinking. And Hahnemann, for some reason, decided he would take the quinquina bark himself to see what it would do. And by golly, when he took it, he got alternating chills and fever, just like the symptoms of malaria. And he had the sudden insight that that was the key. And it was the old, it goes back to Paracelsus, who said likes can be cured by likes.
So which is also the theory of vaccination.
Yes, it is, to some degree. It is. Vaccination is commonly compared to homeopathics. It's done with crude substance, and it's another issue. But yes, it's very similar. So in this case, like the quinine or the quinquina bark, apparently worked because it would resonate with that disease force somehow and neutralize the disease force. And that's the best we really understand it. Hahnemann described it as a way of that the medicinal disease, if you will, was more powerful than the natural disease, although short-lived, but that somehow by taking the remedy whose medicinal disease mimicked the natural disease, that it could basically kick the natural disease out of the body because the body could only deal with one thing at one time. And so the body would throw off the other because the homeopathic remedy would fill the susceptibility that was there that was allowing the disease. Because again, whether it's flu or parvo or whatever, there has to be a susceptibility.
We're talking to veterinarian Don Hamilton about his book, Homeopathic Care for Cats and Dogs. In homeopathic medicine, you work, as you said, with very low dilutions. So you mix something so that it's one part in 10, and then you mix it up again so that it's one part in 100, and then one in 1,000, and one in 10,000. And pretty soon you get up to dilutions where the original substance, whether that be hemlock or arsenic or salt or whatever the thing is, doesn't in any chemical form exist anymore. Why would you need to keep diluting after that? In other words, it's already gone.
That's a good question. It's a very good question. It's not simply a dilution process. It's a dilution in what we call succussion or an agitation process. And so each step, you make the dilution, and then you agitate that vial like 100 times, shaking it very hard. And somehow that energy of the agitation actually makes the substance stronger, so that paradoxically, the more dilute the remedies are, the stronger they are in certain ways in their ability. And so even though you've gotten beyond when there's no substance left, you can continue to dilute further and further and further, and it gets stronger and stronger up to a point. I mean, not really up to a point, but in its own refined way, it becomes very strong. And it seems to be stored somehow in the hydrogen bonding that's within the water molecules when you do it in a water and alcohol. But it somehow infuses more energy into it, and it takes the toxicity totally out because there's no substance, and you're just left with that energetic resonance.
Now, when, and again, this is just from my past reading in homeopathy, but you ask the patient, if it's a human patient, a lot of questions, and they're sort of funny questions like, do you sleep on your back, and do your feet get cold, and all sorts of things that you can't ask your kitty and your doggy. So how do you figure out what's the right remedy for an animal?
It's more tricky than it is for people, for sure, because you can't ask a lot of those. You get certain information. You know your dogs, and you know that Rex will sleep over there by the window where it's cool, and Sadie will sleep right over by the wood stove or whatever. So there are certain ways we can get that information. I might also ask, how does your dog behave if I came to visit? If a stranger comes to visit, is your dog friendly and right up there wanting attention? Does the dog lurk back? Kind of is interesting, but doesn't really want attention. Is the dog demanding to be to get petted? Is the dog really aggressive? You know, so we just have to ask the guardians as much as possible. And then if it's one of those where I can see the dog or the cat, then I also observe the cat and see how it responds to me, and see a lot of those things. So it's a combination of a long interview process with a guardian.
The guardian meaning pet owner or whatever.
Yeah, I use the term guardian because I don't like the concept of ownership. Guardian to me is more equitable, and that's sort of part of that other philosophical issue that I discussed. But so I ask the people what they can tell me and ask them lots of things about it, how the disease came on, what it looked like, because other things we use, for example, if it's diarrhea, I might want to know, does that dog get diarrhea first thing when he gets up in the morning, or does it only get diarrhea after he eats, or, you know, what are the other issues around diarrhea that separate that dog from another dog? Because, again, homeopathy is very individual, so you have to narrow down on what makes this condition different than everybody else. Because when you say you've got 10 dogs with diarrhea, okay, it sounds like one thing, but one dog might get diarrhea when he hears the siren go off or a firecracker. Another dog might get diarrhea when he eats, or another dog might get diarrhea just when she eats fatty food, different things like that. So,
and in all those cases, diarrhea is a symptom, but you still have to get a diagnosis.
It's not a diagnosis so much as an individuation. So it's not treating the diagnosis like, does this dog have pancreatitis and that dog has hemorrhagic gastroenteritis? No, it's more of a, what makes that dog's diarrhea individual, and how does it fit in within the context of that dog? Because I'm treating the dog, not the diarrhea per se. So, you know, other things besides ways the diarrhea expresses, you might have diarrhea in a dog that's very friendly and very thirsty and very outgoing, but frightened of fireworks and things, and that dog might need phosphorus. And then you might have diarrhea in another dog that's kind of irritable when he's sick and he doesn't feel well and he's chilly, and he might snap at you if you try to examine him. That dog might need Nux vomica. You know, so different aspects. So it's an individuating process more than a diagnostic process. We don't treat diagnoses per se.
You're still a conventional veterinarian. Also, are there some moments where you have to abandon homeopathic practice for, I guess, allopathic veterinary practice?
Rarely. I don't do it very much. There are times that I will. I mean, like antibiotics, for example, I might prescribe antibiotics once every 2 or 3 years. You know, I mean, I don't do it very much. Certain things I might, you know, if it's a heart condition or whatever, they may need to stay on some heart drugs while I do some other things. I see allopathic or conventional medicine as a stopgap lifesaver, and then I try to use homeopathics and supplements and things to try to strengthen the animal to get its health back in the cases where it's possible.
If I may ask bluntly, what is your success rate?
It's a good question. And success rate with homeopathy, it kind of goes on a bell curve, you know, and so that I have one end of the bell curve where animals do beautifully and another end where animals don't respond at all, and everybody else is kind of in the middle. I would say the really good successes are probably 20-25%. And, you know, then there's that sort of maybe 50% where you get a certain amount of response. I probably help, you know, 60-70% of animals. And then there's maybe 25% or so that I don't help much.
And how does that compare to your other kind of practice in your own experience?
In my experience, it's favorable because we use different criteria as to what it means to cure or what it means to help and make them better. So let's say we'll take skin disease as one of the worst conditions that we treat. Conventionally, I mean, if you evaluate the dog in, say, 3 weeks or a month, conventionally you're going to be a lot better off because you can put them on antibiotics and steroids and things. Things will look a heck of a lot better. But if you evaluate the dog in a year down the road or 2 years down the road, homeopathically I have better success because in the conventional system you're only masking the symptoms and they'll keep coming back and keep coming back and keep coming back unless you suppress them, in which case they come back as something worse. Whereas conventionally, over time, it takes me a couple years, sometimes 3 years or more, to treat a skin disease because it's a very deep disease. But in many cases I can get them clear and or 90% clear and on no drugs and happy and, you know, and not having to be on any medications or anything. So it's sort of a, where do you take it? It's like within cancer treatment, within conventional therapy, they consider 5 years of remission as a cure in cancer in humans, and they might get a recurrence in 6 years, and they don't kind of consider that as a failure in a sense, you know. And so it's where do you put that evaluation point?
Do you treat cancer with homeopathy in pets?
Yeah, some I do. It's difficult, but I do. I mean, a lot of times I can have similar success to conventional therapy without the side effects. Not in every case. It's very difficult. It's difficult with whatever modality. There are people who treat it quite a lot, and I have friends and colleagues that have done probably more work with it and, you know, and have pretty good success in some cases. But it's tricky. I mean, the guy that's there's a fellow by the name of Ramakrishnan who is an Indian homeopath who treats a lot of humans with cancer. And he says, at least when I heard him in a seminar 10 years ago, he has like 20% really good success with cancer. So, you know, it's low numbers, but it's probably comparable to what really arguably we get with conventional therapy. And you don't have any of the side effects or anything.
We're talking to veterinarian Don Hamilton. Do you use homeopathy to treat your own and your family's illnesses, aches and pains, and so on?
I do, yeah. And I treat our family pretty much. And, we treat ourselves just with homeopathy. We use some herbs as well sometimes, but we don't do any medications or anything like that.
Homeopathy is a system that was discovered, as you said, by this German doctor, Hahnemann. And when it started to be used for animals, is it the same basic, I mean, it's the same basic principles, but is it the same when you take the animal's case, or has it been really modified for animals? I mean, who do physiologically have some genuine differences from us, like dogs can't eat grapes and chocolate, and there's all sorts of differences between mm-hmm. us and them.
Yeah, those things kind of don't matter in some senses because you're looking at who the individual is, and so no, it's not really fundamentally any different. There are differences which really go back to, as you were asking, how do you take an animal's case when you can't ask the animal what kind of dreams do you have, how do you sleep, what kind of things make you angry, you know, things like that. So there are differences in that way.
Although we certainly know what kind of things make our animals angry a lot
of
the time.
We often do know that. Yes, we do. That's right, exactly. But so, you know, those differences are there. But fundamentally, no, it's pretty much the same. Yeah, pretty much the same. I would say one difference, and this is something that I've worked with more recently in the last few years, but is using some remedies to specifically address, for example, the vaccine damage, because unfortunately animals have been a lot harder hit with vaccines because we've historically vaccinated them regularly throughout their lifetime, whereas with humans we don't. And so the vaccine damage is much worse in animals.
We're talking about the book Homeopathic Care for Cats and Dogs by Don Hamilton. Reading this book, will people be able to use it to learn how to, without going to a homeopathic vet who might not exist in the place where they live, to use this medicine for their own animals?
Absolutely. I mean, that was my whole goal and desire over a decade now when I wrote the first edition, was to put out a good handbook that was out there that could teach people how to use homeopathics to treat, you know, acute conditions. They won't be able to treat a skin disease or chronic pancreatitis or certain things, but, you know, an occasional case of diarrhea and many things they can treat. And I get, and one of the nice things in the decade plus that the book has been out has been, I've heard a lot of good reports from people that they've been able to treat their animals for conditions, some conditions in which even they've been to a local veterinarian without success and they've been able to treat it. I mean, that's probably not as common, but a lot of people do have good success. The book has an initial series of 5 chapters which are sort of theoretical, starting with a history of homeopathy and a bit of an explanation. And then I describe what disease is according to how homeopaths see it. And I describe what cure is and what response to treatment is according to how we see it as homeopaths, because again, we see it differently. And then I talk about sort of more specifically how you would use homeopathic remedies in terms of how they're prepared, how you dose, what to look for, and things like that. And then I have a series of treatment chapters, all of which are like one on the skin and the ears and so forth, another one on the respiratory system, another on the urogenital system, and on and on. And so I have individual chapters so that if you have a dog with diarrhea, you can look in the digestive system and look at that section and tell in there, first off, how to evaluate the diarrhea. Is it bad enough that you need to take them into a veterinarian, or can you wait and treat it for 2 or 3 days or something like that? So I give guidelines as to what people can treat, and then you know, when it's okay to treat, how long they can try, and then medications, homeopathic medications and so forth.
There is a whole section in your book exploring the question of our relationship not only to animals but to nature and wild nature, and the difference between a domesticated animal and our relationship to them and wild animals. And I was wondering if you'd talk a little bit about your thoughts and feelings about that.
Sure, I'd be happy to. It is something that's a passion of mine. I grew up spending a lot of time out in nature, camping and hiking and so forth, and I continue to do that. And so wild nature is very important to me. And so one of the conundrum is I also grew up with a household of cats and occasional dog and gerbils and hamsters and various things, and even a couple of monkeys. And while I really love the domestic animals, I'd say in some ways my passion is greater for the wild animals out there. And I have developed concerns over the years that in some ways I think our relationship to our domestic animals is not balanced. In one sense is that domestication basically is a form of servitude. And so it's a master and servant kind of a relationship, that no matter how much we care about our cats and dogs, they're pretty much under our complete control. And that's kind of what domestication is whether it's domesticating plants or whether it's domesticating cattle for our consumption. And the same thing with cats and dogs. We've bred them to be more docile and more amenable to our control, basically. And so
I don't see most of them complaining.
Well, there are a lot that I think are, and I think they don't necessarily complain in ways that we see it, but a lot of certainly some skin conditions that we see are a result of stress. A lot of other illnesses are a result of stress. A lot of animals are actually living in stressful circumstances.
Well, that's true, but I mean, if you give a dog who needs a job some kind of tasks to do, and you give them plenty of exercise and lots of love, I mean, there's a lot of happy dogs.
Yes, there are. There absolutely are. And I don't disagree with that. And it's not those that I'm concerned about. There are a lot that are cute puppies and cute kittens, and then we get busy with our lives. There are also a lot that the people, that the guardians probably don't fulfill their own needs adequately, and they expect too much of the animals, and they ask for things of the animals, and therefore they ask the animals to be other than what the animal naturally would be in its own state.
Which they also do with family members.
Absolutely we do. Absolutely. Yeah. It's the same thing. With family members, other than sort of psychological issues that sometimes limit it, at some point you can go and leave and move out and live on your own and get away from your family if it's necessary. A dog doesn't have too much of a choice to do that. Cats do somewhat if they're allowed to come and go. Cats will choose to move on down the street to another home that they like better. Dogs are more bonded than that, and they don't do it, and they sometimes suffer.
My dog did. My oldest dog. Yeah, she lived next door, and she liked it better at my house, so she moved in.
Exactly. And that's great. I mean, I think that's how it should be, is they should have the freedom to come and go and make their own choices. That's one issue, is yeah. I think we don't give them that freedom. The other concern that I have is that, because I think part of humanity and part of growing up on this planet and evolving on this planet is our relationship to the natural world or to others, non-humans. I mean, it's our human-human relationships are obviously very critical, but I think our human to non-human relationships are very important as well. We can fulfill that to some degree with a cat or a dog that's domesticated in our house, and that's okay. But we don't get the wild nature aspect. And then we also, I think that has somewhat allowed us to continually move in and encroach and encroach and encroach upon wild nature to where there's only scraps of land anymore left anywhere for wild nature.
How do you envision a proper relationship between human beings and foxes, mountain lions, squirrels, whatever?
It's a tough issue, I suppose. I envision it as one with respect. I envision it as one that we don't necessarily kill mountain lions because we call them predators, or because we call them I forget the other term they like to use, varmint species, which they're trying to do here in New Mexico, that we don't kill foxes, you know, that we live in harmony with the ways that we've sort of understood that many Aboriginal cultures have lived in harmony with wild nature, that they understand that they have to share with the animals. They even understand that occasionally a tiger might take a human, and that might be okay, but if it's a tiger that is regularly taking children or taking humans, then they would probably kill it. But if it's a tiger that occasionally might, you know, a person is lost every so often, that's understandable. Or, you know, one of the crocodiles off the coast of Australia that are man-eaters, people-eaters, because they're extremely vicious. People understand that and respect that. I think it's a matter of respect.
And we don't knowing how to stay out of their way, too.
Yeah, not being stupid, knowing how to stay out of their way. And not thinking that if we go and, you know, because I want to live in the woods and I move in there, and then I have a problem that an animal kills one of my dogs or even one of my children, not that I have children, but, in, you know, in that sense, to then blame the animal, but perhaps I'm the one that moved into that animal's territory.
Right.
You know. And so I think it's just a matter of respect and a matter of understanding that they have an inherent right to be and exist out there, and that without them existing out there, I don't think our life is as rich and full as it would be otherwise.
Don Hamilton is a doctor of veterinary medicine. He is the author of the book Homeopathic Care for Cats and Dogs, Small Doses for Small Animals, that is just come out in a new edition. And he will be speaking at Garcia Street Books this Saturday, the 26th of February at 3 in the afternoon right here in Santa Fe. You can find out more at garciastreetbooks.com. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte. It's my pleasure.
We're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome poets Gabe Gomez and Diane Seuss. They are both going to be reading as part of the Muse Times 2 poetry series at Collected Works Bookstore, happening this coming Sunday at 4 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Yeah, good to see you, or hear you.
Now, Diane is coming to us from Kalamazoo, Michigan, and Gabe is a local poet right here in Santa Fe. And I was thinking maybe each of you could start by reading a poem. Do you want to go first, Diane?
Sure. Thank you. Thanks for having me, too. I'm going to read a poem from my new collection of poems, Wolf Lake, White Gown Blown Open. And this is a pretty short poem. It's called Men Displayed the Things We Didn't Want to See, and sort of about the town where I grew up. Men displayed the things we didn't want to see, but needed to see anyway. They'd put on their work gloves and grab a bat sleeping upside down in the attic and hold it still so we'd have to look at its small eyes and fangs, its triangle ears like a little dog's, and the black fuzz on its head sticking straight up like the minister's baby who died from crib death. They'd gut a fish and cut open the egg sac, or take out their own glass eyes and roll them across the table. They'd slip out their false teeth and smile at us, or lead us down to the tracks to see the woman in the car who had been crushed by a train, or anything born with two heads or an eye in the center of its forehead, or the burned velvet curtains flapping in the wind around the black stage when the opera house burned down.
Diane Seuss from her new book. Gabe Gomez, would you like to read a poem?
Sure. This is from a new collection, not a book. Let's clarify that. But yeah, a new collection I've been working on for about 40 years or so. Anyway, this is called Ruin in My Name. If we had stayed to watch the dunes disappear or pretended to have gone to any place quieted in the outer light, the brunt of our exposition falling between the sloughs of eroded sledge route, words pecking sound from the ether, a past tense where order and volume is decided, or where the high rains leapt from that mountain or mass, height that was never quite as congruous to the imagined, I would have read the freshly burned truck chassis, filled in by the creases of the sand with an early vocabulary, whose flames lapped in the curvature of steel slab, never erasing, if not amplifying, the shell and exhilaration in the voices of those boys driving into the night, their faces illuminated by irradiant dials, their hard breath blooming forgiveness or regret, tuned by the trills of blistering paint that came with the twilight. I wonder about the things we would draw from them, how they left with an orchestral idea of searching, only to return with stolen trucks, stunned with their new voices born from this desert in ruin.
Gabe Gomez, from his as-yet-unpublished collection called The Seed Bank, and he also has a book that is available at Collected Works Bookstore called The Outer Bands. Now, the practice of poetry involves a lot of different things. It involves a studious, ongoing attention to craft, an observation of the real world, and an ongoing, I guess what you would have to call is keeping open one's sense of raw emotion and not doing the filtering necessarily as much as the rest of us do in our daily lives. And those are a lot of different things, and I was wondering what the practice of craft and the practice of observation and the practice of emotion, for lack of a better way of putting it, is like in each of your lives.
Mm. A great question. Gabe, do you want to start?
Sure. I like to think that everything that I do, whether it's driving to work or going for a run or, you know, reading, you know, one of my favorite authors or whatever, feeds the poem in some way. And that eventually, if I listen closely enough to a bit of language, to a conversation that I had 12 years ago, whatever it is that sort of happens to cross my mind, then the poem will sort of erupt or begin from that. So I think at all times, no matter how I'm interacting throughout the day and whom I'm interacting with, and I think it's just a matter of being attentive to those moments where that first line or those first two words or that little sense of rhythm that you're kind of looking for and you know, you want to shape it with words will come about. And so that's really at least how I do it. I try to make poetry into sort of like a almost like a living practice, almost, you know, and just being sure to be there for those little moments where they realize themselves. So that's kind of how it works. And then sometimes, you know, having studied it formally in, you know, school and MFA and all that stuff, it's, you know, you really sort of, you have to think about it very deliberately. So there's a balance of both just the kind of the spontaneity of it all, but then at the same time you're making art. So there's times for all of it. So the majority of it's just gathering information, and then I would say about 10% of it is just like actually putting it down, you know?
Right.
So that's how it kind of, I mean, at least for me and how it works. And it really takes me a long time to write books or write poems. You know, my first collection took about 6 years. This collection is, you know, I've been, hammering it out for the better part of 4 years. And so it takes time, at least for me.
Diane?
That's a good answer, Scott. I am with you on the notion of having to stay awake for those things that come along, whether it's a phrase or a moment of observation that opens the poem up. I feel like in my own life, I've kind of winnowed my life down to poetry as my poetry's my partner and my religion. It's who shares my bed and my house. I was a single mom for a long time, and so I had to find a way to integrate poetry into, you know, between the diaper and the chopping broccoli. And I'm a teacher, too, and so a big part of my writing practice is also my teaching practice and the way that my students work and struggles, feedback in my own. Right now I'm on sabbatical for the first time in my life, and I get to kind of live the life of a writer fully for the first time. And for me, that often involves getting myself into the natural world in some way. And being able to observe the patterns and motion of the natural world in a way that feeds back into my own work. Even if what I'm writing isn't about the natural world, that somehow seems to trigger me. And then just being human, you know, I don't elevate writing poems above any other kind of work. In fact, it's kind of lightweight compared to shoveling snow, for instance, here, or a lot of the other kinds of work that people do. It's work, and so there's that aspect of it that's just grinding it out day after day. And the other thing for me is just trying to extend what I've already done, not get too comfortable rattling my own chain. And so it's very important for me to keep growing as a writer and as a person, and they're totally intertwined.
Right before I started talking to you guys, I ran into an acquaintance of mine who's a writer, and he said, and I said I was about to interview two poets, and he said, oh, I had this most wonderful experience in high school. I hated high school. I was depressed. I was a terrible student. And we had a resident poet who was there in our school for 2 days. I got talking to this person, and it changed my life. And I wondered, for each of you, both of you involved in education, if you had some experiences or some sense of that teacher-student relationship and how poetry is affecting the lives of some of the people you come in contact with.
Sure. I mean, when I was teaching full-time, certainly one of my favorite, I think if you're a writer of any kind of, and you're teaching, you're going to be confronted with a comp class, with a composition course. Certainly my case, at least at the, when I was teaching, and, one of the coolest things that, I would encounter, I would often incorporate, poetry into my composition courses and, you know, as reading and other things. And you know, that's where, you know, these sort of freshman classes where you get the entire cross-section of a university. You know, you get the engineers and you get the humanities majors, you get the pre-law, pre-med, and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that I was, you know, really excited about sometimes with poetry is I was teaching between 2001 and 2006 in New Orleans and the rest of the time here in Santa Fe. But some of these kids that would come back from Iraq and these other places who would, you know, literally would just be sort of thrust upon back into society and into, you know, a freshman composition classroom, and just had to deal, just had to learn to be, you know, sort of a person again. And you could see the transition. It was often difficult. And sometimes you would just have to, you know, with poetry, you could do a lot of different kinds of things. You know, it doesn't have to be this sort of really super rigid rec comp structure or whatever, or it can be. But with poetry, you know, you sort of, you know, there was a few instances where some of these kids who had come back, and I say kids because these, you know, we're talking about, you know, 20-year-olds and stuff, and they would, you know, we would find a way to communicate, if ever so slightly, or successfully through poems. And I think poetry is, you know, having that that canvas has such a vast and really wonderful blank canvas. That you could really sort of filter a way to you know, get those ideas out that you want. There's order, and then there's this sort of madness behind it. And I think poetry, if you're trying to just find your grip in the world, is just a wonderful thing. And I think I really sort of was able to see that firsthand with some of these kids coming back from the war. And that's, you know, I'll never forget that. I mean, it was unbelievable. And even though It was a comp class. It was just a regular composition, you know, 101 freshman English right. Sort of thing. And so, but it was really wonderful. It was really, and then that firsthand was really, I thought it was a really moving experience.
Diane?
Yeah, I teach only creative writing at the college where I teach. But what's amazing is that, like your friend, I was raised in a very rural area, little high school out in the cow pasture. And a poet in residence there for a day changed my life. Conrad Hilberry is his name. He's still alive. And he said, I heard you write, and why don't you show me some of your stuff? And I had a my dad's briefcase, my dad who had passed away, full of poems. And his eyes were the first that ever saw them. And we read together, and he actually didn't, he followed through. He sent me books. He encouraged me, and he got me money to come to college. And it's the college where I now teach in the position that he held then. And so I have a great feeling of indebtedness, and also feel that the work that I do with students is a continuation of what was given to me, which was really, I mean, the easiest way to say it, he gave me my life. I think in a lot of ways it probably would have been very, very unusual for me to have found my way out of that little town without some kind of voice outside of me saying you can do that. So that's what I try to do for the students that I work with. And not only as individuals, but I work in classes. I think of the writing class as a community, and that we're all there hoping for the best for each other as well as ourselves. And so it becomes almost an alternative way of being, a unit of measure that's very human, unlike the, you know, gigantic mass culture that they're all part of. The writing classroom is a small community. It's a small town. I could say tons more about it, but I'll stop there.
That's what an amazing story.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. And he's still living. He's 82 now. And I actually teach him. I do a workshop for adults, and he takes the course. And I teach alongside him, too. So
it must be a wonderful thing for him to know that at least, and there's probably many more, but at least one person has his legacy the way that you do.
It sounds like a TV movie, but it's real. And actually, I talked to him right before you called me to let him know I was doing this. And he's quite a well-known poet nationally, but his approach to poetry has never been competitive. It's very gentle, and it's all about encouraging everyone to find that in themselves, and that's what I've tried to continue.
We're almost out of time. Maybe each of you has a very quick poem. Does either of you have a short one that we could end with, either or both of you?
Yeah, I think I have somewhere
around. I've got shorties in here that I can read.
Okay.
You want me to start? Just
yeah, Diane Seuss.
Okay. This is another poem from the little town where I was raised. It's called It Was the Idea of the Calf I Loved. It was the idea of the calf I loved, and not the calf, though it licked me with its tongue covered in taste buds like barnacles. I'd sleep with my head on its warm side, pretend to sleep, pretend to like to be alone, though I wished I was in the fieldstone house with the narrow winding staircase and a spigot in the wall that gushed lemonade, playing caroms with the old folks. The calf came with a story. It had been rejected by its mother. I liked the idea of feeling sorry for it and tying orange ribbons around its ears. Its black watery eye, a planet of black water and no continents. If you sailed that sea, you'd have to sail forever. When it got the bloat and died, I invented sadness, reached down into my emptiness like a wishing well, and drew up a small wooden bucket of tears. They knocked down the lean-to with the green tractor. The calf was never mine, though I said it was.
Diane Seuss, and unfortunately we're out of time, so to hear Gabe Gomez's next poem, you'll have to go to Collected Works Bookstore on Sunday at 4 in the afternoon. It's the Muse Times 2 poetry series. Diane Seuss and Gabe Gomez, thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Doubtfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.